Manx Radio's Countryside is brought to you by NFU Mutual.
Hello and welcome to Countryside here on Manx Radio. I'm Simon Clark.
And I'm Kerry Kermode. I caught up with a visitor to the Isle of Man, Rhys Williams, to talk about joint farming ventures and succession. And I also catch up with David Christian from the World Manx Association.
And I catch up with John Quayle, who's wore many hats over the years, growing up on the farms, still on the farm, and, of course, heavily involved over the years in the Royal Manx Agricultural Show setup and committee. Well, plenty to get through today, Kerry. It's been a wet old week, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been desperate. It's certainly changed now and it's got that wintry vibe down to the single digits in the temperature too. So, yeah, making people remember it's time, the time of year's on, and maybe getting stock inside.
Yeah, but the stock coming inside this year, I think, has been pretty good for feed and straw, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The harvest has been good. I know the north have struggled a little bit and the drying did affect them, but there has been plenty of straw, lots of grass, even grass down our way still being cut for silage at the minute, or just before the rain, should we say. But no, the stock is looking well too, so let's hope for a nice winter.
Okay, well, you've been out and about firstly.
I have indeed. I caught up with a visitor that was over to the Isle of Man, Rhys Williams, a farmer himself, and he brought along a lot of knowledge. We caught up with him at the Fun Barn to hear what he had to say about joint ventures and succession planning.
Small family farm at home, really, 60 hectares, just a grass-based system, really, with a simple system, dry stock, trying to make most of the grass, sort of align my stocking rates with the growth, with the grass growth we've got, and just sort of like maximise grass, really, so I buy in some store lambs and get some contract with some heifers during the summer. Yeah, and try to maximise with some intensive rotational grazing. So yeah, that's what I do at home farm. And then yeah, hour and a half up the road on the North Wales coast there in Colwyn Bay, I set up about 10 years ago now. Set up a farming joint venture with a large landowner there. And yeah, not quite the same because the context is a bit different. Where we've got breeding stock there, so more New Zealand type farming system there, where we've got sort of 2,000 outdoor lambing Romney ewes, sort of no fertilizer, no purchase feed, outdoor lambing, rotation grazing, and try to introduce more sort of regenerative practices in those systems as well, with sort of deferred grazing, bale grazing, and just trying to make the best out of the natural resources, really, and hopefully regenerate the soils while we're at it.
That is absolutely incredible, because you see a lot of intensive farming now around Britain. You see it a little bit here on the Isle of Man, not so much so. But Wales is such a great place. It is the grass growth and all the rest of it. Where did you get the idea from to have the low input systems? Was it something you grew up on the farm?
Well, first of all, you know, I've only been in my Isle of Man for a day, but really there's not, you know, much difference here. I think you've got huge potential to grow grass here as well, really, in the Isle of Man. So I don't think it's vastly different to Wales, really. But yeah, my inspiration, obviously, when I was I've been to New Zealand a couple of times, and also previous job I used to lecture at a college and taught grassland production and so on, and did a lot of research on New Zealand type systems. So really it's those type of model that I've been inspired by, and it's been, you know, there's similarities, really, in that, really, you know, what's happening here in the UK now with subsidies. Well, in New Zealand in the 80s, it was in the 80s, really, in New Zealand, when subsidies got pulled out overnight, really, and at the same time they floated the dollar, and inflation and instance rates shot up. So it was a real challenge for them in the 80s, and they turned into sort of rotation grazing and using more natural resources then. So really, you know, it's the same sort of thing I was thinking about in Wales, really. Eventually, when we do end up with no support from the government, I want it to be sort of sustainable and financially viable without any support. So we're looking at New Zealand type systems, really, and try to replicate them, really, in our context.
And it is hard to believe that you can actually farm without fertilizer.
Yeah, it's if you really think about it, it's what our forefathers were doing 100 years ago, really, before fertilizer and before purchase feed. You know, we've become slightly, not what I would say lazy, because, you know, feed and fertilizer at one point, you know, was probably economically viable to do so. But it's the feed and fertilizer that have allowed us sort of to take the risk out of farming, probably be more consistent. But but managed correctly, definitely our pastures have got this potential to sort of outperform set stock systems with fertiliser. You know, rotational grazing, intensive rotational grazing without fertiliser can certainly outperform that, really.
Yeah, and I loved the story there before where you were saying you're stitching in clover. Like, clover is one of those age-old sort of lays that has been forgotten about a little bit.
Yeah, and that's linked to the fact that, you know, we're being dependent on fertilisers. So nitrogen doesn't work with clover. You know, it outcompetes it. So really, the fact that we had nitrogen-based systems sort of left us with no clover. So obviously, clovers are fixed nitrogen. So not only would they provide us the nitrogen, but they provide us quality feed and they provide us a bit more sort of resilience as well in dry weather and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, how do you manage through the winter months? You know, there's an awful lot of ewes, 2,200 ewes. They're outdoors. You don't have sheds to put them in. How do they cope with it? Is it the breed?
There's obviously it's a resilience breed, a grass-based breed, the Romney, and they're good utilisers of forage. We've gone away from, we've never housed really, but we did at the start of the venture, we were putting in forage crops, but we're thinking that, you know, that involved input as well and more costs, so we wanted to reduce those costs as well. So we were looked into more regenerative systems and stockpiling of grass. So what we do now is we still do a bit of hay. So we place bales in deferred grazing areas, and we unroll bales, sort of bale graze alongside stockpiled grass, which is grass we've kept really. Rather than to keeping it for silage, you keep it sort of in from midsummer onwards, defer it, and strip graze it through those winter months, sort of January and February.
And what do you do with the lambs? Will you fatten them off your home ground, or will they be sold on?
It's been a bit of change of systems in the last year or so, really, in that we've been, traditionally we have been trying to fatten them off grass, which has been, partly successful, but it's some years more difficult than others, and we find that we are probably taking a bit longer than we wish to finish lambs, so we've taken the plunge this year, really, to change system a bit and sell all our lambs to store, which allows us to destock really in late summer and allows us to build more cover for winter to help that resilience over winter and also prioritise the ewes in the back end. And if we prioritise the ewes, and the ewes really are the engine of our business, if we prioritise them, hopefully we'll get some gains in scanning percentages and in ewe health and so on.
Yeah, that is so great to hear. It's just such a natural system. But also to hear your talk tonight when you were talking about the share farm and the land is from a certain person, the labour is from another person and yourself investing with the sheep. To get that a collaboration is something really quite special. Is Wales got itself sorted out for the succession planning or this kind of venture?
I think that, you know, similar dynamics in Wales really as in the Isle of Man. It's the age profile of farmers is pretty old in Wales, so and the added problems with this inheritance tax now, and so adds to the succession problem. But you know, joint ventures can possibly sort of help with regard to that in the transition of the management to the younger generation. And we've been very fortunate to have been linked up with Harry Featherston Hoare in Coed Coch, really, who's been a very open-minded and very good landowner to work with, really. We had a sort of aligned goals, and he's got the right mindset for it, and we're very, very lucky.
And how does your share farming business compare to your business at home? Now, I know that your father's still very active on the farm, which is wonderful to hear, and you've got a young family coming through as well.
It's different. It's a family farm, so dynamics is a bit different there because, you know, it's a more traditional setup, really. You find that the joint venture is probably more professional in this way, in that it's more business-minded and more business-focused, whereas obviously if we're a family farm, it's more difficult to have those that sort of a more professional feel to it. Yeah,
there's a lot more emotion as somebody raised in the audience here tonight. But the one bit I did like also, Rhys, was when you talked about mental health and the controllables. You're able to control certain aspects of farm life, your concerns and your influences. How do you overcome that? You know, because we can all dwell on the prices, the market prices and all the rest of it. How do you handle it?
Yeah, it's accepting, really. It's building a system that it's not dependent on those factors, not needing to have sort of a good year with prices to be profitable, not needing to sort of have to be fertilizer prices to be at a certain level, or for feed prices to be at a certain level, sort of controlling the controllables. So and the controllables really are the things that we can do something about, is our sort of our own farming system, our own the way we treat our stock and the choices we make on our businesses, rather than worrying about sort of the weather and worrying about prices, about worrying about fuels and so on and so on. So it's about managing yourself, really, and it does help when you sort of explain that to yourself from a mental health point of view, and when it's just a mindset, really.
It really is. And how do you see young people's future in agriculture, Rhys?
I think there's definitely opportunities. It saddens me to see some, maybe a generation of people think sort of advising young farmers to go out and find other work and find another trade, or go elsewhere for work, when there is an industry here needing that energy and enthusiasm that youngsters would bring. The way I look at it, there are opportunities out there if you're prepared to look for them, first of all, and if you're prepared to think outside the box. And really, we're very fortunate. We're very fortunate in the way that, managed correctly, I'm very confident that we can make a living out of farming. If we really look at the numbers, if we really make business decisions, if we really if we really work and also work with the natural resources that we've got, there is potential there, and I'm very confident that we've got the talent and we've got the resources here to produce healthy, nutritious food economically that will benefit everybody.
There we go. That was Rhys Williams from Precision Grazing and Coedcock Farm Limited.
Yeah, it's a tricky one to say, Kieran.
It is indeed.
With that one. But it's tricky over there. There's a lot of mumbling and grumbling, and it's taken its toll, this inheritance tax, by the sound of it, on farms.
It really has, and there's still a lot of unknown with it. He's got a young family himself, a younger farmer too, as we heard. Lots of decision making to be had. The prices have been good, that's one thing that he does mention. But yeah, it's going to be a tricky road ahead, I think, with the inheritance tax. Who knows?
Well, a prominent name over agriculture and the royal shows over the years is John Quayle, a farmer from Ballyvarran in Derby. Well, John's still on the farm there, and he's still heavily involved and still in the loop about what's happening in the agricultural world. I caught up with him to find out more about how he grew up on the farm, the buildings they've still got in great condition on his farm, and also his involvement with the Royal Manx Agricultural Society, plus his fur and feather hat. Well, firstly, John, Ballyvarran Farm, it must have been a family one before you were growing up, was it?
You go back into the 1800s when my grandfather and all was in that. He came up from Sandygate as a young man with his aunties, and he farmed there. Then that was in the late 1800s. And then, of course, he got married, and by 1907, my mother was born. She was the first of eight of a family.
Really?
And they carried the farming in Ballyvarran all the time, right up until he died in 55. I was born in 1939, and my mother lived in and father like, and I lost my father when I was only seven. He was an engineer at Kelly St. Michael. But he was working because we had a threshing machine at the time and going round a yoke, as we called it.
Were they there then, John?
Well, the threshing mills. There wasn't many around, but gradually there was more, came on the north, but apparently my grandfather had the chance to buy one and he bought it, and we were going round all winter sort of thing. Or two of my uncles, two of my mother's brothers were, and my father, I think, was on it for a little while, going from farm to farm and threshing. There'd be 2 or 3 days in certain farms. It went as far as down to Cranstall, almost to the point of Ayr, to a farm there called Kerridoo, Mr. Kissick, and there'd be a couple of days threshing there or more. Right. And they were in various places on the north, like, and used to go up to Narrowdale. There's about 5 farms up there at the time, and our mill used to thrash the lot. And then they'd go up at Ballacurn and Balaff. They'd go up Ballacurn and go across the fields and come down at Bishop's Domain. They wouldn't go up that way. It was too steep when you only had a steam engine, and you had to take the mill up first and then come back and get the baler. And it was the same coming down, because it was too steep. You couldn't come down with the whole lot in the one go, because you would slide with the steel wheels on the engine.
Is that the first sort of memory? Were they good times? It seemed to be good working crews that seemed to get on together working with them.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, you'd be helping your neighbour, and I think you would be the same way. Your parents would, or your father would be the same way. You'd be helping next door, like you'd be going for a day's thrashing there to help. Then you'd get help back when you were thrashing. And it was the same on the farms around me at Ballyfarren. But you see, in 1937, they started to make the JB Airfield, and there was about 60 acres taken off Ballyfarren to make that.
Really? Yeah. I mean, for people who won't know where Ballyfarren is, it's right adjacent to the JB Airfield there.
And, yeah, it's almost
and was that a big effect on the farm?
Yeah, it had to be, you see, because there was... My grandfather had 5 sons. One was a blacksmith, and the other 4 were working at home on the farm. Well, 2 was out in the winter on the threshing, but the other 2 were home. And in the end, he took on rent next door, Ballymore Farm. We had it for about 9 years, so that helped. But the main part of that, over 200 acres, 230 or something, was taken to make the JB Airfield of Ballymore.
Right.
All the top land, the good land now, like where there's no ditches, no drains or anything, early land, and they lost all that. So,
would they have taken that, or would they give something back, you know, as compensation for it?
Well, at the time, Ballyfarren was only rented. It was rented from Christian Northop, or Christian the bank in Peel. And anyway, when apparently I heard my grandfather say that when this happened, he got in touch with the landlord, and he didn't get any compensation, but the landlord did. And he took him to Peel, because Christians then owned various properties, Ballywattleworth, Ballycallan, Ballycrane, and there's one with along the main Peel Road, I just can't think of the name of it at the present, and he offered them one of them. So he had a look, and he come back and he said, we'll stay where we are.
But it's fairly unique, because you're sort of on the peak of a hill, really. Was that a helpful thing with drainage, or did it make it awkward?
Ballyfarren. Well, up above the house where the airfield is, it was dry land. And if you had a dry year, well, fair enough, you didn't get too good a crop, because you weren't ploughing as deep in those days, because there'd be horses. And down below, I know there's only about 30 foot of a drop, but down below the ground was sort of
meadowy, was it?
No, it was good, fertile land, not a stone in it even.
Really?
And you went right down then to the Corax.
That'd be a good one for the plant and the spuds then, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, the topsoil. You could go down about in places, about foot in one field, about 4 foot, and you still have topsoil.
Wow.
And then down the bottom, and you went towards the Corax, like you come into more turfy land, but still, you always were sure of a crop. It was always a bit later than up above, but you, if you had a field down below and one above, you're always sure of getting a decent crop or a decent year, you know. So it's not like as if it was all dry. I said, you know, Cronk Breck could be very, very dry, wasn't it?
Good for carrots and turnips.
Yeah, but they've said you only had half an hour's thrashing, you see, sometimes. Because it was a dry year, that's all you would get.
Yeah.
But at least we always had the sort of it was in it was levelled out and moderation sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. You always shoot off a crop somewhere.
But yeah. It's strange, you know, your farm, that the buildings, you know, when you look at your buildings are still there, still like in the pristine conditions. They wouldn't be, you wouldn't get many of the modern tractors in them, John. But it's great to see it there with them, the brickwork and everything on them. And that's something that's lost with a lot of the farms, the smaller farms around the island now, isn't it?
Well, you see, it's really, it's in U shape, if you know what I mean, on the sort of the southwest side. You've got the higher buildings, and that protected you from the southwest storms. Then on the northwest, you've got a still higher buildings, not quite as high as the first lot. And then on the northeast side, you've got a lower building. But so you've got the midden in the middle, and which is traditional way, I think. But ours, you could come in off the Hackett, in onto the corn barn where you used to keep your oats and all after it was thrashed. And you could put your straw in and your hay in on a loft, and then you'd feed it down through the scuttles, as we call them, into the cattle. And then you clean them out every day, like with the grep behind the, when they were all tied in stalls, and you wheelbarrow, whatever, and you threw that down into the midden as well, so you're always working downhill.
And it's marvellous to think back then the design was worked around what was easiest for the farmers to work, wasn't it?
Well, you see, the older buildings, the highest one, I've said, there was, a horse mill, as they called it there, for thrashing. But the wheel, the horses on the top side, walking around in a circle, driving
the grinding
wheel, thrashing, and then the chaff went down to what they called the chaff house. It was only narrow. Then the other one was where the straw was all loose, of course, but the grain then was up on the loft. And the remnants, I think, are still there of that. And then, of course, the other two, the top, the northwest side, and then the southeast side, the northeast side, that was all built of slate from the quarry and starch mill quarries up in Silver Glen. And I think my uncle, Willie, the oldest of brothers to my mother, he carted some of that stone there. And if you go to them, in certain places, you can see in one or two of the stones where in the quarry where they drilled into the slate to put a charge in to blast it to get there. And there's at least two stones in that building where I can go to. We can see where the drill had been drilled into to put the charge in.
Wow, but I mean, they were tough. They were tough times. Farming back then, as it is today, but in a different sort of context. But was it an enjoyable sort of friendly sort of environment, really?
Oh yes, because you see, at night time, I can remember them even at Sandygate Corner, congregating of a night time, those on the farms and the farmers themselves, there for an hour sort of thing talking, and then they would all dispersed. Some were, I suppose, would go up the Solby to the pub or to the Ginger. But then in the winter and all, they had the reading room, and they always had somebody were in charge of that, and they would go there and meet, and there would be, billiards, I think, was the big game sort of thing at that time, and there was darts, and they'd be playing cards and whatever, and a fire going, and, you know, and they all congregated together and talk about what you'd done today and what were you going to do tomorrow and all this type of thing, and they all got on well. Yeah.
John Quayle from Ballyvarran Farm, tell us about what things were like growing up on a farm right next to the Jerby airfield. And we'll have the second parts about the Royal Manx show and also the Fur and Feather on next week's programme.
It's magnificent. Yeah. The older farmers on this island, they're a wealth of knowledge. And John, a mainstay there with the Royal Manx show, but always a nice person to talk to. Like you say, a lot of knowledge we've just heard tonight. And we've got to record these things because even that Manx accent is something very special about it.
You're listening to Countryside here on Manx Radio with Kerry Kermode and myself, Simon Clark. Well, we heard from a good old Manx farmer there, John Quayle, a few minutes ago, and it fits in well with the World Manx Association.
It does indeed. Yes, I caught up with David Christian, the chairman of the World Manx Association, at a recent dinner. I asked him what it was like to be a Manxman himself.
I've been a member of the World Manx Association since 1997, the year that I was mayor. My auntie, the mayoress, Iris Christian, she's a former president of the World Manx Association. She got me involved, made me a life member. So I followed everything that they've done over the years, but played no major role because there's only so many balls you can juggle. But nearly 3 years ago, the association looked like it was closing. Not many people turned up to the annual general meeting, so an extraordinary general meeting was called. We gathered a few people together, we went along, I think about 40 people turned up, and I came away from that meeting having been elected chairman of it. I'm pleased to say the membership has grown in the last couple of years. Obviously, some of the membership is of the older age range, so we are losing as quick as we are getting new members in. But I'm really proud to be chairman of an association like this, and to speak and hear some of the stories that you hear at an event like the T.E. Brown Lunch really means something to me. And I like to think, being as Manx as I am, that I know a lot about our island. But when you listen to the likes of Charles Gard today, you realise how much you don't know. And you just learn from these events. And you learn from some of the people that have been in these associations for many years.
And that said, Charles Gard, a great speaker. He could put it together so well. But the short videos he had here today, David, were of places on the Isle of Man that even I haven't seen or didn't know of. That history is still evolving for us.
Oh, it most certainly is. And I think a lot of Manxies on the island feel that they are losing their history. They're losing their heritage. But it's a case of we must all be there to preserve it. And through associations like the World Manx that was formed in 1911 by Richard Kane, based on something that T.E. Brown, our national Manx poet, had said. And the association's been going for all those years, but also other associations were formed around the world, the most prominent one being the London Manx and also the North American Manx Association, who have emailed today to turn around and say that they're actually meeting today in North America to celebrate, to commemorate T.E. Brown as well. And 2 years ago, 46 of them came over to the island for the whole of Timwood Week, went to Timwood Fair, did many of the things around the island that we as Manxies take for granted. They went to Milltown. Now, we've seen what Charles Gard has said today about what they're doing with Milltown. I thought, I drive past it that many times. I've never been in. You know, it's now on the top of the list. I must go and pay the visit. But they went away from the island feeling they'd been back to a place of their birth, from where their ancestors came from all those years ago. And that's great to think that all that distance between us, that still the Manxness has been talked about, and they still want to know the place of their ancestors' birth.
That is actually hard to believe. When you put it like that, globally, they come back to this. What is the draw with the Isle of Man? You know, it is a phenomenal place.
It is. There's something special about it. And I know that day in, day out, we can all moan. But I often say to people, look at what's going on around the world at the moment and give thanks for how lucky we are. Within a couple of minutes, you can be out. I mean, I live in Douglas. I've represented Douglas all those years. But it is great. Within a couple of minutes, you're out. You're out into the wild countryside. You're never far from the sea. Wherever you go, there is history and heritage around our island. I think that's what's so special. That's what draws people back. And we've been talking on our table today and to His Excellency the Governor, who is the patron of the World Manx Association. And he was explaining how it's been put over to him about people who leave maybe after university, but they are always drawn back. They come back, whether it's when they've got a family or whatever, they come back to the shores of Elenvannen. And I think that is so important, and may that continue for a very long time to come.
It is brilliant, David. And you've said it in a nutshell here this afternoon. the World Manx, you're going from strength to strength. You want more people to get involved. You've got some great events coming up.
We do. We put a calendar of events together for the whole of the year. And we've actually set up a subcommittee now, and we're going to look at the constitution of the World Manx Association to see what has changed from when it was first formed in 1911, because obviously things do change. We don't have the people leaving the island, going to America to live now, emigrating. We don't have the other people coming back here to welcome them back and put an arm around them. So we want to make sure that there is a purpose and a meaning of World Manx. So we're going to look at that, and at our AGM next March, hopefully we'll put some new proposals to the membership that turn up, looking at the membership, how do we bring new members in, how do we make it more relevant to today, and ensure that we continue our national history, our national heritage, and we keep what's Manx, Manx.
And how do they get in touch, David?
Facebook is one of the main ones at the moment, so it's World Manx Association Isle of Man, in brackets, and we load up all the events that we do so people can see the type of events that we hold through the course of the year. You and your family are big supporters of the events, and I know how competitive you get at our quiz nights as well. We always hear your table down the bottom end. But it is great. You've got all those Manx connections and the true conditions with farming and all the rest of it. That is so important. It really is. So it's bringing people like that together. So look at Facebook. People know how to contact myself, Elaine Christian, our president. You know, feel free to contact us at any time. We'll talk to you about the World Manx Association, but we'll welcome new members. Come and speak to some of the new members who've joined in the last couple of years. They keep coming back to the event, so we must be doing something right.
There we go. That was David Christian, the chairman of the World Manx Association.
And it's funny, we think of the Manx Association is sort of kept here on the Isle of Man, but goodness me, far afield, isn't it?
It's brilliant how far it's got, and the internet has brought it so much closer, though. And it was great to see photographs being taken at the luncheon and to be shared on the different pages for around the world. Like David said, it's great to keep these things going, so we need a lot more young people on side. So if you're out there listening and you want to get involved, do find the Facebook page of the World Manx Association. They're very welcoming, and it's such a great thing to be here on the Isle of Man and the heritage and culture it has to get involved with.
Indeed. Well, don't forget, if you missed any of the Countryside programmes or want to listen to it again in the fuller versions of the interviews, just go to manxradio.com and download the podcast, or you can get in touch with us if you want something for the programme, countryside@manxradio.com. That's it for this week. We're back next Tuesday at 5:30. Till then, from me, Simon Clark.
And me, Kiri Kermode.
We'll see you then. Ta-da.
Bye-bye.